Good evening, everyone. My name is Jeanette. I'm an alcoholic. And a couple times as I was thinking about speaking at this meeting, and I drive to work in Zainuba, so I'm going down the road and I'm, you know, pitching my talk. And I have to remember that I want to stay in the moment as much as possible today, both when I'm in my car driving and when I show up here, and I just ask the God of my understanding to help me be useful. And maybe some of you will relate to parts of my story and not other parts, but I think the true power of this program, as we've heard earlier tonight, is one alcoholic helping another. And my story is my story, you know. And I drank and I got beat up. And I looked for another way to live. Well, actually, I didn't look for another way to live. My boss looked for another way for me to live. And if I wanted to keep my job, which for me meant I was okay, then I didn't have to hope somebody was going to get me loaded, wasn't going to, you know, buy me what I needed. I could take care of myself. And that pushed me for a long time to continue showing up for work in all different levels of inebriated states. When I was about 4 years old, my family moved to Colorado to this nice little self-supporting institution. I guess it was kind of a cult, you know. We lived on a big farm out there, and everybody worked in the garden, and we raised vegetables and went to church a lot, and a very wholesome environment in many ways. My family, well, we stuck out like a sore thumb. You know, we were kind of like the community disgrace, you know. It was just like, I guess you call it white trash, you know. Our house, we just didn't keep it up, and that wasn't important to my folks, and so it was, I always felt kind of different, you know, kind of like I didn't belong, kind of like I was an embarrassment, you know. People were talking about me. And from early on, I always thought people were talking about me. I had an overinflated sense of importance. You know, on this very nice little community, nobody smoked, nobody cussed, nobody drank, and only went to church a lot. And when I was about 14, we moved away from there, and this happens and that happens, And you know, fast forward through the adventures of adolescence. Do my first drink, you know, because by the time I got 17, which is I've been around the rooms for a while, I understand it's pretty mature for most of us to start drinking at 17. But that's when I had the opportunity to experience alcohol. And what an experience it was. You know, I was living up in Paradise with my grandparents. A lot of stuff going on in my family, you know. And my aunt, who was like 21, took me out to this bar where she worked. And it was herself and the bartender and me. And we're there, and it's after hours, you know, and I'm feeling all so grown up. And they give me this drink, and then, you know, I'd never really thought about drinking. I hadn't been around people that drank. I hadn't been exposed to what happens when people drink. And it was awful. I mean, why would you give a kid a Black Russian for a first drink? It was nasty, and I didn't like it. And so then they gave me like a 7-Up with some vodka or something, and I don't know if they were, like, sitting around, like, you know, I used to get my dog high, a little smoke in his ear, and go, ow, the dog's all messed up. And so that's what they were doing with me there in the bar. But, you know, I could taste there was still alcohol, but, you know, I'm hanging out with them. And you know, pretty soon, you know, I've got, like, this margarita glass, and they put all these strawberries in it, you know, because I can't handle a Black Russian. We've got to have something sweet. And, you know, I'm 17, and I'm all full of myself. Anyway, so I'm here, and I'm, like, licking the strawberries out of the glass, you know, like, teasing the bartender. You know, and I'm thinking I'm so sexy, you know. And And then we go back to his house, and him and my aunt go in the bedroom, and I'm like on the couch, you know, recovering from drinking. And the second time I drank was when the magic of alcohol enveloped my body, and I became a different individual. And I became somebody who was enough, and who was powerful, and who was beautiful, and who felt that sense of ease and comfort I always wanted to feel. I had no doubts about my ability. I had no doubts about my worthiness, my attractiveness, my anything. I had arrived. And alcohol fixed me in a way nothing in my life had come close to. And I loved it. I loved the effects of that drink. It fixed me in so many ways. It took like this sense of not belonging and of wondering what was going to happen to my life and, you know, so many unanswered questions at that age and a lot of stuff going on in my family. And it just fixed me. And, you know, there it was like four of us high school kids sharing a bottle of Boone's Farm, you know, apple wine. Or maybe we had two, I don't know. But it was wonderful and it tasted good. So, yeah, I dug that. And, you know, right away, I understood that alcohol did something for me that I needed done. It was clear to me that this was my magic potion. This was my solution to life's ills. And when a few days later, you know, the boyfriend I'm interested in hasn't called and I'm again feeling alone and separate and isolated, I know if I can get something to drink, I am going to be okay. And I did. You know, I went down to the boyfriend's brother's house that lived a little ways down there and had a couple of these, it was Beefeaters, you know. I guess it was gin, I don't know. But I remember walking back to my grandparents' house where I was living and I'm looking up at the stars. And I'm thinking how I am one with the universe. And how life is good, and I'm mellow, and it's all going to be okay. I left Paradise and moved back to Colorado and became a ward of the state. My parents were still going through a very challenging custody battle, very bad divorce. And, you know, I didn't have a chance to drink all the time, but every chance I had, I drank. And when life got hard, and for me it was a lot around relationships, I was sure if I could find the right guy to love me in the right way, I was going to be okay. That's really all my life was lacking. And I was sure that this magical relationship was going to fix me in a way that I wouldn't hurt anymore and that I, you know, would be good. I'd be good. And when that didn't happen and my heart got broken, I knew if I could drink, that would make me okay. And I went to extremes. You know, I can remember hitchhiking to my, you know, one more time, a friend's brother's house that's old enough to buy the stuff. And, you know, it's late at night and I'm out hitchhiking. And that seemed like a reasonable thing to do. You know, when I got enough booze in me, and I swear I will never touch Southern Comfort again, but that's what I was drinking that night. And I'm growing up, and I'm sick, and they're trying to, you know, put me to bed and take care of me, and then they go because I got to take someone else home. You know, in my clever alcoholic mind, you know, I call up Mr. So-and-so who's broke my heart, and he hangs up on me. And so, well, the next thing I need to do is be a mobile drunk, you know, and I start heading back to my mom's house, and there I am at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, still pretty drunk, hitchhiking home, you know. And those are the kind of things I did when I drank. I'm a reasonably intelligent person. I make decent choices. But when I start drinking, I can't like the logic, it just goes out. Whatever seems like the next best thing is what I'm doing before I've even made a decision about it. I'm doing it, you know? I probably had my first blackout about 19 years old, driving from Colorado Springs to my friend's house in Windsor, still in Colorado. And, you know, and I'm drinking peppermint schnapps, good winter drink, you know, and there's snow all over the place. And I'm going to see my girlfriend. And, you know, and it takes me like 4.5 hours to get there, and I've got bits and pieces of that, you know. I pick up a hitchhiker because, hey, why'd Nick drive alone, you know, it's good to have company. And so, yeah, let's drink some of this schnapps and everything, and then pretty soon he says, why don't you let me drive? And I'm like, nobody drives my car but me, you know. And, you know, he says, well, how about we stop and get some coffee or hot chocolate or, you know, coffee. Well, I don't drink coffee. Well, how about hot chocolate? And so we stop at this truck stop and get some drinks, and then pretty soon I'm realizing that my hitchhiker has left me. And I'm sitting in the booth there at the truck stop bawling, you know. Hey, I'm drunk and it hurts. You know, and once again, bits and pieces of memory and the last part of stumbling up the steps at this little convenience store in a town out in Podunk, Colorado. And I'm hanging onto the payphone on the wall, and I'm aiming for the number. And I can still remember that look of disgust and like, pity that the people in that convenience store cast on me. It was just like, they were disgusted that I'm out driving these snow-covered roads that drunk. You know, and then that sleeping on the waterbed and knowing I'm sick, and that you shouldn't sleep on the waterbed when you're drunk, but not getting it together enough to get off the damn thing so that I'm not so nauseous. And, you know, I drink and I drank and had a lot of fun and I went places, and about 79 I moved to San Diego. And I loved California. And not only was it warm, booze was sold in every store. And in Colorado, you got to go to a special store to buy your booze. And it was hard to rip off, you know. And that's what I did, because I, you know, needed something to drink, and I didn't have the money. So the old five-finger discount was my favorite approach to purchasing my drink of choice. And living in California in San Diego for about, that's about 2 years I lived down there. And trying to be okay and having more consequences with alcohol, trying to hold down a job, you know, drinking on the job. I thought I was so clever, you know. I would, like, get Kahlua and pour it in milk, and then they thought I had chocolate milk. You know, how clever is that, you know, really underground with it. And drinking in the morning. Lived out of a pickup truck for a while, parked by the little airport there in El Monte, you know, after I moved to LA. And I've got this whole romantic idea with this drinking, you know, it makes me feel good, and I'm a nomad, and I'm living on the road out of my truck, and I've got food, and I've got booze, and I said, hey, you got a garden hose, you can shower, you know, what's the big? And somehow through all of this, I've managed to hang on to some kind of job, because I had to have the money to take care of myself. I wasn't going to hope somebody else was going to do it. And I was incredibly driven. You know, hangovers, whatever, I'm showing up for work. And I ended up getting hired on with a utility company down in L.A., and I hated living in L.A. That's what was killing my spirit. It was where I lived, you know. So I needed to move. I'm really a country girl, and if I can move out of the city, then I'm going to be okay. And you know, I'm drinking every day. I'm trying to be okay, and I've just got a raging hole right in my gut, right in my chest, just running through me, and I'm just thinking if I can find the right guy, if I can get enough love, if I can get enough booze, if I can just get enough. I'm going to be okay, and I just want to be okay. And I want to experience that magic and that sense of fulfillment and that sense of well-being that alcohol brought to me that first time, that Boone's Farm, back in Paradise, California. I want that. And if I can get there, and I kept trying to make that happen, you know, but I overshoot the mark. Because I start partying, and it's that physical craving, you know. When I drink, I want more booze. It fixes me, and I don't want to stop, not if there's something left, not if you can get some more, not if there's, you know, an alternative somewhere else to go. There's got to be a way. And, is there any water around here? Can you see this water bill? And, you know what happened for me was, I get this good job, you know, and I decide, okay, I don't have to steal stuff anymore. You know, I've been just too many times tapped on the shoulder, excuse me, miss, did you put something in your purse? You know, so I decide I've got this job and I'm gonna get it together. This job is gonna fix me. Ended up moving to Bakersfield, transferring with my job, then once again up to Visalia, and looking to fit in and looking for a way to be full, looking for a way to have enough. So I move up to Visalia, and I'm looking for the party because, you know, How do you connect? How do you find people? You know, we look for the people at party like I do. And I can remember a lot of faces out there, and some of you may not have been around when, you know, Licorice Pizza was on Mooney Boulevard, you know, right across from Faces, which is where I love to go and sit in that barber's chair, and they pour those shots down your throat and stitch you up, and it just like hits the back of your throat, and you know, I love the way it made me feel. And so I'm looking for the places where the people are hanging out that I can identify with, you know, that I can relate to so that I'm not so alone and lonely and bored and, you know, trying to be okay. And I started partying up here and hanging out with the crowd. And, you know, these were my kind of people. I felt really important hanging out with these guys, you know. They're packing little M16s and shooting the moon and partying in all kinds of ways. And they let me hang out with them, you know, and I feel pretty important. And I'm hanging on to this job I got because it means I'm okay. And I'm staying up till 4 and 5 in the morning. And then I'm laying in bed with my heart beating like it's going to jump out of my chest. And I'm going, well, at least my body's resting. I'm going to be okay. I'm going to get up. And I'd get up and I'd go to work and I'd sit in that chair in my little cubicle and I'd just kind of rock and hum because I was, you know, I'm just trying to comfort myself. I'm just trying to be okay. Why is it so damn hard just to be okay? And, you know, I got in a lot of trouble and I had some blackouts in California, you know, I don't know, what's a lot of trouble? Everybody's got their definition, you know. I got arrested, not for drunk driving that time, but for outstanding warrants, you know, little stuff. And then I'm driving over from Bakersfield, and I get my drunk driving, you know, and they haul me in, and, you know, I'd love to impress you with what I blew on the tube, but I have no idea. They kept me. And I don't really want to stop drinking because I know that magic is in there. Somewhere in that bottle is the magic that fixes Annette, that fixes that hole inside of me that just, you know, it's like the melting snow. It's just, it's hungry, it's empty, and I am. You know, what happened for me was I knew I was drinking too much, and it absolutely had my life. And I told some friends, I'm going to go check out this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I know I'm drinking too much, you know, and I need to get a little handle on it. Need to cut back. Need to not go the places I go when I drink. I don't need to stop drinking, but I need to stop doing the stuff I do when I drink. And I went, and I could not get out of there fast enough, you know. I didn't want anybody to talk to me. I didn't want anybody to see me. I didn't want to be there. I'm just there because something's not working, and I told somebody I'd go. And then about, I don't know, 8-9 months later, I'm into it with my boss once again. And I've been into it with her for 2 years. You know, less than satisfactory performance. Screwing up all over the place. Getting people's utilities turned off because I'm not alert. So if I owe anybody out there an amend, you know, got your power turned off when you didn't deserve to have that done, we'll just do a wholesale on that one because I have no idea. But, you know, one more time my boss calls me in there and she says, you know, you seem like a pretty bright person, but here's these 7 major mistakes you made yesterday and I'd like to help you and I don't know what's wrong. It sounds so wimpy, you know. Then I told her, I said, you know, sometimes I drink too much. And I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. I'm sick and tired of trying to keep this woman off my back. And sick of trying to stay up, you know, till 4 in the morning and then rest for an hour and then get into work and to be okay and to make it happen. And to, you know, I'm trying really hard to keep up this look good. And, that boss who she's tough to get along with, she really was, even after I stopped drinking. She got on the phone, she found out what my insurance would cover. And she said, well, we think you should go to an inpatient program, you know. So I go down to interview them. You know, I'm thinking I've still got all these options. I'm kind of arrogant and full of self-will and self-sufficiency and pride and, you know, I've been holding my life together and making it work. Thank you very much. And so I go down to interview this this recovery place and end up, you know, and I remember those two women sitting there and saying, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I'm like, oh, no, I've got a place to live. I've got my utilities on. I never turned off my own. I've got a car to drive, and I've got you know, rent paid, and I'm doing just fine. And well, why are you here? Well, my boss, you know, get them off my back. It's those people over there making life hard for me. And I stayed in that recovery home, and it was awful. Oh my God, it was 8 women in this one little room, and nobody liked each other, you know, and everybody's like detoxing, and we had the detox right in that little room in the corner bed, you know, and we'd get wet ones in, they'd be throwing up in the corner, and you're there trying to sleep, and they held us to AA meetings all the time. And you know, all the fighting, I don't want to do that shit, I'm doing this to take my job, I don't want to be an alcoholic, I don't want to give up this one thing that works in my life. And, you know, I didn't drink, and I guess a little bit of wanting something other than what I had, wanting a little more than pretending. Wanting something different than staying up till 4 in the morning and trying to look like I'm doing okay. And hanging on to a job. And hanging on to, just hanging on. And I was introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous through this recovery home. And I can still remember when I had my first spiritual awakening. And it wasn't the clouds parting and it wasn't a beam of light. It was up at Kaweah Lake at the second boat dock on a Saturday night, and I realized I wanted more for my life. I wanted more for my life. And I'd heard people in these rooms talking about how that was possible, and they seemed to be having a pretty good time. And they talked about drinking how I drank, and I knew that they weren't lying because they told it like it was. They told me where they'd been, what they'd done, and how it had affected them. And I identified with the feeling, and they drank in the morning like I did. And it made just a small beginning, you know. So I stuck around, came to meetings, found the social stream, went to the dances, you know, kind of sort of tried to sponsor. And I hung out that way for 5 years of not drinking, and I got crazy. I was nuts. I'm still looking for him to fix me. My finances are out of control. I am a mess sober. And I'm thinking this is, you know, what's this about? You know, and I'm miserable, irritable, and discontent. And at that point in my life, I knew if something didn't change, nothing would change. And I got introduced to a woman who talked to me about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she asked me if I'd ever worked a thorough set of steps in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I haven't drank for 5 years, and without AA, you know, I might be dead, but you know where I really need help over here with my relationships, you know, because I can't seem to get him where I want him and make him stay there. And she told me, I believe if you work a thorough set of steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it will affect all areas of your life. And I said, well, I can appreciate that. You know, I need AA. But where I need help with my relationships. And she said, I believe if you work a thorough set of steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it will affect all areas of your life. And I heard that. And I began for the first time in a long period without drinking, of really applying the steps that they're written out of the book. And she showed me how to do that. And she took time and walked me through the reading of those pages and showed me what does step one look like, what is step two, because I've got a lot of ideas in my head. I don't know where they come from, but I believe them. And she kind of helped me dispel some of those more harmful ones. I became, after a period of not drinking, convinced to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. I proved it to myself a lot of times when I was drinking. Didn't know where I was going to end up, what I was going to do. But I kept thinking that the magic would come back out of that bottle and fix me in the way it had. I began working the steps with her, and we met every week for an hour. And I had homework, and I had assignments, and I went to meetings. And what happened for me by working those steps was a transformation. I changed from someone who was just pretending, who was just trying to look like I was okay, to feeling more comfortable in my skin, to feeling more at ease, to actually having some peace and serenity. Because when I wasn't drinking and didn't have a program, I was running around. I'm going to 5 different 12-step groups. I'm looking for him, and I'm trying to be okay. Kind of like I did when I drank, except I wasn't drinking. And when I started applying the steps to my life, the magic that is Alcoholics Anonymous became possible. It wasn't possible by just not drinking for me. Here about 6 years ago, I changed sponsors. A woman moved to Visalia that had what I wanted. And she had a very powerful program. And it's a miracle the way I met this lady. She lived in Sierra Madre, and she was moving up here. And she had the foresight to contact our central office and ask for the name of a sober woman that she could make a connection with before she moved, because she'd moved several times, and she didn't want to move cold to a new town sober and not have anybody. And so we started corresponding, and wow, we shared a lot of the same ideas and a lot of the same beliefs and the same practices in the program, and so for about 3 months before she moved up here, we kept in touch. And the reason that's a miracle for me is because when I met Patty, who became my sponsor, she is someone I could not have let in my circle. She was too beautiful, she was too thin, she was too rich, she was too together, and that intimidated the shit out of me. And I had to put up my walls, and I had to keep people like that away. But see, I already loved her, because I'd met her, and I'd shared my program, and I'd shared my life with her. And so God softened my heart up a little bit so that I could let this teacher in, so that I could learn what it was that she had to teach me about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've not yet. You know, it's like layers. I've built up so many defenses and so many ways of protecting myself and so many, you know, keep you away from me so you can't mess with me. But they've come off slowly, you know, and I've had to work to be open, because that's not my nature. That's not how I am safe. Patty used the 12 and 12, unlike my first sponsor, who was strictly out of the big book. And the big book and the message in there and the work laid out, however, was sufficient to bring about an incredible transformation in me. When I worked through the steps again, you know, it's like one of that layer of thread had come off, and then there was more information in the 12 and 12. And I really appreciate that. You know, when I was ready, I guess, when the student was ready, the teacher appeared. And most recently, what's been going on for me is I've once again found myself in collision with people. You know, it's like they're not behaving the way I want them to. They're not staying put. They're not acting right. They're not treating me right. And they're not very cooperative. And so I'm sharing this with my sponsor because I stay in touch with her on a regular basis today. Because there's something about a sponsor that knows me. You know, I can't see myself. I can bullshit myself this quick because I want what I want when I want it. And my sponsor sees me. And she can help me see myself. But without that aid, I don't. You know, I believe what it is that I want to. And so she had me write about these, you know, ways I've been in collision with my husband, with my friends, at work. You know, what's going on there? So we did this mini inventory, and then she had me get in steps 6 and 7 out of the 12 and 12. And she said, you know, we're going to stay here for a while, and here are some layouts to help you stay within good practices as a spouse and as a friend. And, you know, it's amazing to me. You know, I'm a person who I make things happen. You know, I want to go places, I want to see things, I want to accomplish things, I want stuff going on. And I'm a mover and a shaker, and I like that about myself. But the thing is I get too far out there, and I'm stepping on the toes of my fellows. And I'm running the show, not sharing the show. And I've always said I want to be a partner, and I want to be a friend. But, like, there's got to be a give and take there. And it's not just all about my good ideas, you know, and maybe I didn't really want to be a partner. I just wanted someone to follow along and execute all my good ideas. You know, that'd be fine, too. And as I've been working this, step 7, I've been getting the gifts and the rewards of the work. And as I read through this, I was so glad to read that it was incredibly painful, this ego puncturing, because that has absolutely been my experience. I'm only trying to make sense and be a friend and make sure things turn out well. You know, all my intentions are good, and yet my actions are those of a dictator, perhaps. Although, you know, I mask it with all the appropriate blah, 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 so that I can, you know, get my way. And so when I told Patty that I was speaking, she said, talk about step 7 and where you're at with it. And for a long time before Patty became my sponsor, I'd give the spiel about how I drank and how I got sober and how the transformation had taken place in Jeanette. And wasn't that incredible? And you know, today I get up here and I can say, you know what? I'm as human as the next person. I'm still finding myself in collision with people. I still have to stay in touch with my sponsor. And I continue to work these steps because my own best ideas put me right back into selfishness and self-centeredness. And that's a natural place for me to be. And I love the 12 and 12. I mean, that could be a little snapshot of me next to this paragraph and that paragraph. You know, it's just me, and I'm going to read a few pieces that I outlined this last time I went through it. It says, we are sure no class of people in the world ever made a worse mess of trying to live by this formula than alcoholics. And they're talking about getting what we want. For thousands of years, we have been demanding more than our share of security, prestige, and romance. When we seemed to be succeeding, we drank to dream still greater dreams. When we were frustrated, even in part, we drank for oblivion. Never was there enough of what we thought we wanted. In all these strivings, so many of them well-intentioned, our crippling handicap had been our lack of humility. We had lacked the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values had to come first, and that material satisfactions were not the purpose of living. Quite characteristically, we had gone all out in confusing the ends with the means. Well, that pretty much sums it up for me. I just see that my spiritual connection with the higher power of my understanding, and I came in here with a lot of God stuff that I had to, like, unload. You know, I was so full of what I knew about God, I had no room for new understanding. And there was someone that pointed that out to me. And that was useful. Because I'd have a lot of church, and I was able to say all this stuff. But to actually bring a God into my life that could fight my battles for me was beyond me. You know? And this is where I'm back to again, here with this step 7, is asking God to do for me what I can't do for myself, which is to get rid of my defenses, to get rid of my defects, if you will, the thing that separates me from my fellows and from God. And I'm really still an undisciplined person. You know, I have a hard time getting up in the morning. I am not a morning person. And, you know, I get new information. It's like if I want to receive the benefits and continue receiving the growth and the progress and the rewards that I found, maybe it's worth changing some stuff over, you know? I still haven't done it, but I'm sure that I will soon. The other part I want to read on 75, as I've been going through this incredibly painful work on humility, says, we saw we needn't always be bludgeoned and beaten into humility. It could come quite as much from our voluntary reaching for it as it could from unremitting suffering. A great turning point in our lives came when we sought for humility as something we really wanted rather than something we must have. It marks a time when we could commence to see the full implication of step 7. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. God has a lot of work still to do in me. I hope that God uses me to do some of his work. I think the message I have to offer tonight is one of hope. That someone that drank like me, that drank every day, that drank in the morning, that didn't drive home from, you know, where over there on Linwood to Lover's Lane, I didn't drive home without a drink. That was how I rewarded myself for showing up and putting in that day at the coal mine, so to speak. Someone that drank like me, someone that drank like us, has the opportunity to recover and find a life that, well, it hasn't been easy for me, but it's been so much better to know where I'm going, you know, when I get in my car, and to know where I've been when I get home. And I'm grateful to be sober. Thanks for letting me share.